south old front ride now one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. As I mentioned last time we got together, I was lucky enough to recently come across a volume of cowboy poetry and short stories, often brief reminiscences, by real cowboy Bruce Kiskaden, so we will continue reading it today. This is Shorty's Yarns, Western Stories and Poems of Bruce Kiskaden. And this volume is by Kiskaden, Field, and Seams, published in 2004 in Logan, Utah, by Utah State University Press. And before we begin, let me remind you that our stories are sometimes edited slightly for recording. Our first story is entitled Rough Hands. A rough hand is a heap of help, providing he has sense with it. No boss wants a feller that's allus trying to make a good hoss buck and holding up the crowd in the morning, see him put on a wild riding exhibition. And most owners would a heap rather hear a waddy talk about how to shoe and how to keep a horse in shape and learn him to work than about how high he can kick him in the shoulder when he's bucking. A real forked hand is worth plenty all the time, but he ought to use judgment with it. A wrangler that charges a bunch of shod saddle horses in a narrow place and gets some of their heels tromped on or a good horse kicked and lamed is a loss. For hands that don't train horses and bring them 20 or 30 miles to work just to have them lamed up in the remuda. Then take, on a drive, there's always the fellers that bunch up and ride along visiting and reading their saddle horns till the herd takes on a whale of a spread, and then takes down the ropes and runs her horses and chases weak cattle or fat steers, neither of which ain't no good. And a feller on day herd that is either pulling up brush with his rope to see how much his hoss will pull, or else making or fixing it something till the cattle scatter, and then getting out and raising the devil. The hand that always has his rope ready when it's calf branding time, or that's there to pull him out of a bog or doctor screw worms, or can take an old moss back out of a brush or a rough mountain, is a real man and no fooling. But the feller that sets in a winter camp and bakes his boots at the fire, when he ought to be out chopping ice so the critters can drink, is like enough to be the one to get out along in the afternoon and bust some old lame steer on the froze ground to look at his foot, when him and the world all knows he's just tender from being around the rim rocks. I ain't saying but what I've tried to show off sometimes, and I've lamed up hosses and crippled and even killed stock when I could have got around doing it, but I'm plumb ashamed of it, and the bosses was better about it than I would have been if I'd been in their place. But I will say that I mostly tried to take care of things and not to do damage, and always figured that the boys and the cook and the boss would a heap rather a feller drug in a little wood and was willing to help cook a little, if need be, than to put on a Wild West show when there wasn't no use in it. Lots of boys that is top hands is setting on the fence somewheres or hanging around town, or maybe so chuck riding, and don't know why they can't work twice it for the same outfit. But if they'd take a couple of drinks to sort of give 'em a broad view of things, and generally speaking set down and get wise to themselves, they could figure out why some awkward hands that can't ride for sour apples or throw a rope into the crick is always working, and they ain't. The rough hand with sense is a fine for any boss, but the rough hand without no sense is as about as much use as a flywheel on a curry comb or a bulldog in a sheep camp. This story is Haircutting. Mind how we used to clean up after the work was made and most of the boys had pulled into the home ranch with the wagon? Yes, sir. We sun blankets, wash clothes, got right busy. By the time we was all sudsed out and shaved, it was about time to do some hair cutting. Sometimes there was a chair or two around the bunkhouse, but most of the boys had rather sit on a box, 'cause it seemed a heap more natural And then, two, any cowpuncher that really could cut hair had learned on a box, and a chair sort of cramped his style. And some of them boys could sure cut hair. We got out the old comb and worked it on a tight string till we had most of the gum out of it, and then we got a whetstone and sharped up the best pair of shears that was around the place. After that, all we had to do was to set them on the old store box and take to it. To be sure, the shears might pull some, and old comb might be a little shy of teeth in spots, but that wasn't our fault, and it didn't worry us none. I don't know what you would call the style of haircuts we got, but anyhow, they wasn't no fancy pompadours among 'em. Then, too, we had sort of a clearinghouse balance. All the little fellers that sent out for clothes mostly found when they got 'em that they was so big that if they went out in a high wind, them shirts and pants would have whooped 'em to death. But that was all right, for they just fitted the big fellers, and the big fellers found out that the first time they washed their clothes, they shrunk till they fitted the little fellers. It was only the medium-sized boys that was out of luck. When we all got slicked up, there's generally a country dance timed for about then, and for a day or two after we rode 10-15 mile to sit and watch some gal chaw gum, or if she was right high-chinned, she had an old organ and she sung In the Gloamin' and After the Ball. Well, she tromped on and pawed that old organ. After that, it was time for 3-4 months more work. Folks today would reckon it was a pretty slow time, but we allowed we sure was cutting a fat hog them times, and was a whole lot happier than them that knows a heap better. This is Wild Dogs. During the winter of 1900, there was a bunch of dogs did considerable damage to calves in the part of the country where we lived. They were dogs of all sizes and breeds. One was very big. Several dogs from ranches joined them. As a rule, they killed any honest dog that came in their way. There was a strip of ground between two deep arroyos that was honeycombed with clay caves, and some of these came out between the two watercourses, and here they denned up. They were as well protected as a prairie dog town. Only one of them was foolish enough to get into a trap. We then tried poison, and that thinned them out pretty fast. But two big dogs and a couple of small ones still kept it up. One day late in March, I rode into a big arroyo and jumped three of them. One was the big fella. The wind must have kept them from hearing me, for we were right amongst each other before we knew it. I cut down and up on the big fella. The first shot went short, but the next one wallowed him. By that time, I'd rolled off and leaded him plenty. He was as big as a St. Bernard and in fine condition. That was the finish for them, and in the remaining 4 years that I was in that section of the country, they never showed up again. Small calves was their favorite dish, and several times they tore down meat that was up outside of houses or camps. Luckily, many of my fellow readers have had similar experiences. If you have, please write it to Western Livestock Journal. Our next story is entitled, Wolves. This is not a trapper talking. I never could catch anything in a trap but a polecat, and, come to think of it, I pinched my fingers a time or two. Some years ago, two boys went out onto a mesa to trap wolves. Later we asked an old trapper if they got anything. Yep, he said. One of them catched pneumonia and died, and t'other one catched a train for home. That's about how the average feller gets a wolf. The winter of 1901, I was left at home alone for 6 weeks. Twice during that time, the old dog came into the house growling, and next morning I found wolf tracks. I was left a door open for him. They never bothered anything that I knew of. Wolves went through that country, but didn't seem to stop or kill. The next winter, I was crossing the valley to get to my dad's home, and I met a wolf right in the fence lanes. There was snow, and I could see him plain. He passed within 20 yards of me on the other side of the fence, and didn't seem to take any notice of me. The next winter, Joe Morgan and I were at a place on the Chicosa Arroyo, working for Jim Gresham. I took Joe's pet hoss and went to chop a water hole open while he made breakfast one morning. It was just light enough to see when I got there, and there was some coyotes around a carcass. But closer was a big lober. Why they go near a carcass, I don't know, for they killed their own meat. Well, I dropped my axe and charged him. He was hawkered on the getaway, and the little hoss was raring to go. We stepped right up to him, and I had a loop built, but I had to guide the horse, for he wasn't follering worth a darn. The wolf took a dodge in a cactus patch, and when he did, that little horse just run off with me for a ways, and when I got him bent, that wolf was somewhere else. Anyhow, I chopped ice. The toughest wolf I ever knowed was in northern Arizona. He ranged over a lot of country. Indian Jeff got a couple of wolves, and so did another Indian, but this old boy kept right on killing calves. Charlie Duncan took a peeve at this wolf and put on a rifle for him. Charlie and I worked together that summer. Every time we heard him bawl the kill cry, it made us cuss. The varmint was just too smart for us. It lasted all winter and into the next summer, that feud did. It got to be a sort of steady idea of Charlie's. One day we came back to camp at Horse Flat Tanks, where we'd been 2 days before, and the wolf had gone into the ashes of our fire and dug out pieces of jerky and bacon rind and biscuit. That settled it. Charlie took to building little fires over a trap and mashing them down a little with a pan and putting bits of grub in them. I reckon it was about the third fire that he fell for, and he sure got his foot in it. He was the biggest one I ever saw. Always thought a lot about wolves. Ain't all the same, and no wolf is the same all the time. But there ain't time and room to talk about them in a paper, so I beg Mr. King's pardon for this long-winded yarn. This is Reptiles. Most all fellers that's worked on the outside has a lot of rattlesnake and centipede and tarantula yarns that they have told so often that they get so they believe them theirselves. Now, I don't claim to be no snake expert, but I try and sort the snake yarns that are true from amongst them that ain't. I hope all you boys will reckon I got the bunch clean and classified up all right. There's a heap bigger stories than these, but then there's a heap better snake men than me, because one time I went to try and help sober a feller up, and he could tell me about a lot of snakes that I couldn't even see. So I figured I wasn't much of a snake man. The worst snake scare I ever got was when I was a kid. I went out to fix some pasture fence and run out of wire. I had an old axe along, and I went to cut down a few buckhorn cactus and drag into the break till the next day, and just as I hit one cactus, a rattler whizzed, and a piece of cactus flew off and hit me in the leg. I dropped the axe and fell back on the seat of my overalls to die right now, but when I grabbed for the bit place, I found there was a cactus pod there, and I revived. Another time, me and another boy about my size stopped overnight at a place, and the man was holding it down had raised some melons. When the sun had been down long enough that we allowed the melons had cooled, we all went out to the patch. The big feller was ahead, and he weighed about 200 pounds, and he jumped a rattler. Not one of them that piles up and waits, but one of them little devils that comes a-ramblin', rattlin', and a-snappin' all at once. I was the first one out there, and I says to the other boy that I don't like them kind of snakes. "Snakes, hell," he says. "I was running to keep from being tramped to death by that big feller." One time a bunch of us boys camped in an old corral, and there was a shed where they had fed meal cake the winter before. It was a nasty rainy night, and one feller drug his bed into the place where they'd kept the meal cake. A little later, we went to go in, and a rattler whizzed. We couldn't find him, and hadn't no light but matches, so we bedded down under the open shed. The feller that was already in there allowed if they didn't like his company, they could do the next best thing. The rest of us, well, we wasn't quite that tough. One hot morning, a bunch of us woke up and one of the hands had a daddy long-legged spider on his neck. We told him it was a tarantula. That old boy snuck around soft and careful for about 5 minutes to keep from insulting that spider, and when it got around where he could see it, he liked to chase everybody out of camp. There's a cook got bit with a centipede one night when he was walking around camp in a pair of slippers. It was a big old centipede, and it looked like he had clenched and then half raised and grabbed again, for he made a Y-shaped bite. He corded his leg, and the blood popped out on all them little places where the centipede had tracked. I had a good-sized bottle of permanganate of potash, and I just rubbed the crystals into the places. It sure made him shake that leg. His leg swelled bad, and he was lame for a day or two, but he went right on at work. I shook a scorpion out of my pants one morning before I put 'em on. I prefer doing it previous to doing it afterwards. It's sure safer. This is Old Time Country School Days. The kids has more fun now than they used to, and has a lot more clothes and picture shows and things. They don't have as many sisters and brothers and as many lickins as we did, and they don't have to go and build a fire in their old schoolhouse and thaw out on a winter morning. But I reckon they miss out on a lot of things at that. One time we had a teacher down in the Missouri Hills, and she comes from a big town. She asked more fool questions and knowed less than anybody in the settlement, not barring one old cuss that argued the world was flat. She seen some hogs that had their tails froze off the winter afore, and wanted to know why their tails was cut off. And one big boy told her that they got such big gobs of gumbo mud on their tails that it stretched the hide on their face till they couldn't get their eyes shut, and the flies put 'em blind. And she believed it. There was two old hound dogs that we always took to school, and I reckon they knew about as much as most of us at that. One morning, we run a cottontail rabbit into a rock pile and dug him out. We got him by the hind leg, and he wasn't hurt none, and we put him in the school marm's desk. When school took up, she raised up the lid and see that rabbit a-squatting in there. She allowed it was a rat, and she sure give up a yell. We opened the door and poked him out, and he got out of doors and took to the timbers with both hounds after him. The school marm told the directors it was the biggest rat she ever see, and that he had a tail over a foot long, which we figured was some tail for a rabbit. Come Christmas, we penned her out and made her treat, and the directors allowed we hadn't done no harm, so she sort of throwed in with us. Yes, sir. She even rode a mule to a country dance and helped doctor a couple of sick babies that winter, and we reckon she orter settle right there for life, but she was too darn good-looking, and a town feller married her the next summer. But if she'd got a couple more winters in the hills, she'd sure have joined up with us hillbillies, and no mistake. Yes, sir. One recess, they was two boys a-fightin', and she run out there to part 'em, and slipped and slid on a patch of ice in front of the door. She slid plumb out from under her petticoats, and we saw that she wore the old red flannels same as our ma's did, and we figured her in for one of us right now. That stopped the fight, for she took our mind off fightin', and no mistake. Often wonder where she went, but us kids sure didn't like her, for she was the only school marm we ever had that was young and good-looking, and laughed more at a joke than us kids did. I reckon a lot of old fellers has went to that same sort of schoolhouse and bent down hickory trees and ate pork sausage and cornbread and lived to a good age afterwards. This is the Traveling Schoolmaster. West Queensland, Australia, is a funny place for an American to get into, or was about 20 years ago when I was working there. They work different from us, and their cow talk ain't like ours, and their way of thinking and living is all different. A pasture is a paddock, and a roundup is a muster, and the range is a run, and the home ranch is a homestead, and a fence rider is a boundary rider. They rode flat saddles and carried long whips, and nearly every station hand and drover had a tin pot on his saddle to boil himself a pot of tea with his lunch. But what seemed odd to me was the traveling schoolmaster. This feller takes a team and a buckboard, and makes the rounds in a certain section of the country, gets around every 2 to 3 months. He sometimes has to wait a few days if his pupils are visiting on a nearby station, as they call a ranch, or if some boy is out helping on a muster. He waits till he catches all the kids on any station, and then he examines them to see what they know. And after that he leaves them some more books, and takes the ones that they're through with, and drives on. They can never tell within a few weeks when he'll land on a place, because he has to wait sometimes in a place, And then again, the roads may be pretty bad after the rains, for that country can sure get boggy in wet weather, and bridges just ain't. So you see, the traveling schoolmaster has to be a pretty good bushman himself to get by. Funny thing is, the kids all seem to like him, and it is plumb surprising how much they learn, and the most of them are mighty proud to tally up with him on what they learn while he's away. When he leaves, it is not uncommon for one or two kids on those big leases to ride 5 or 6 miles to open and close a paddock gate for him while his team is still a bit brash, for he has to use what he can for hosses. There's no feeding in that country, and sometimes a hoss gets away on him, and the hoss they stake him to may not have had much harness work. Yes, sir, him and them kids is partners from the word go. And when I think how a lot of them bush-raised kids check up their affairs with him and act like real little men and women, it makes me plumb ashamed of the way some kids that get a real break act in this country. But the government don't put nobody but 100% man and gentleman on that job. Our next story is entitled, It Was a Draw. Joe Morgan and Anse Craig were terrible fellers to tell big Wendy's and ask fool questions, but they both made their brags that they never told a yarn that they couldn't explain, never ask a question that they couldn't answer. One night over at Flat Lakes, they tangled in a camp. Anse Hay started it. Speaking of speed, says he, I mind one time I was working for the Circle Diamond outfit and jumped an antelope. I was on my top horse, and about a mile from there I catched him, and just as I snubbed him up short, my shatter catched up and come alongside. How you figure? He says, looking at Joe. Tain't nothing, says Joe. You's going too fast for your shatter to foller. Reckon that's about right, says Anse. Speaking of speed, says Joe. One time up to Utah, a mighty fast old Shep dog jumped a cottontail rabbit, which ran around a haystack and dived in. Old Shep thinks he's still running, and the fourth time round, old Shep catched hisself by the tail. Joe looks at Anse, and Anse says, He naturally run his old tail off and was around to catch it before it hit the ground. Joe nods, and then Anse says, Speaking of musketeers, instead of speed, when I was up in Montana, they had musketeers that would sit around on the trees and bark, and a great many of them would weigh a pound. When that one hit Joe, he set up and slid like a cutting pony, but he was staying with it. He bites off a chaw and spits and says, I reckon that's about right. They couldn't set on the trees without setting on the bark, and take enough of them, they'd weigh a pound, great many of them. Then Joe asks Anse how a ground squirrel digs his hole and don't throw out no dirt. Dunno, says Anse. How does he? He starts at the bottom and digs up, says Joe. How does he get down there? Asks Anse. Dunno, says Joe. That's your question. You answer it. About then, these two outside men come in, and by the time we help them unpack their beds and throw their horses to the remuda, Joe's and Anse's high-power talk got all busted up. And this begins a section called Concernin' Bill. Speaking of Bill, the first time I ever see him is a little mountain town up in Colorado when we was both a heap younger than what we are now. I was looking into a mirror, which same don't give no favorable opinion of myself, so I takes the looking at a large picture on the wall. It was a large lady in May West clothes, and she's sitting by a table and holding up a big glass of beer. There is a picture of a goat mixed up in the affair, but things were sort of hazy at the time, and time ain't improved things none as regards the goat. I hears argument at the other end of the bar, and a feller's saying that this here country is so mountainous that there ain't no room to do nothing. Then I hears Bill say, You're sure wrong there. This country is stood up on end like, and you got 4 sides and the top to use, whereas in a level country you only got the top. As for it being rough, I've mostly been able to get what I went after around here. Yeah, says the other feller, and leave most of your clothes and a lot of your hide on the brush. Clothes don't make the man, says Bill. No, but they go a long ways toward keeping them from freezing to death in the winters they got up to these parts, says the other feller. I goes out and forks my hoss and starts up to where I'm working, And who catches up with me but Bill, and we get right friendly. About 3 miles up the creek, we find a hand that has been throwed and kicked in the head and has his brains oozing out. We finds his hoss, and there is a big spur track across the saddle, so we figure it's an accident. We goes back to town and gets a buckboard and a doctor. When the doctor gets there, he looks at the feller and says, "That's his brains." "Sure is," I says. "Can you two fellers swear that this man was a cowpuncher?" asks the doctor. Bill says he can, and I remarks that he was in a work I was on about 2 weeks ago. The doctor takes our names and hightails it for town and don't wait for nothing. About 2 months later, Bill and me is in town and we meet this doctor, and he won't have nothing to do with us. So after a few drinks, we goes up to him and tells him to name what he's sore about. "Well," he says, "you mind that feller you found up on the South Fork of the Crick with his brains kicked out? I went and reported to the medical world that I'd made the amazing discovery that a cowpuncher had brains, and I give you 2 Rannies for witnesses. They wrote to some of the natives here, and them natives wrote back that you 2 fellers was the biggest liars in these parts, so my amazing discovery won't go down in history." There's a heap more I can tell you about Bill, but we ain't got room here on account of paper only having 2 sides. This is Bill's Engine Trouble. There's one engine affair that ain't never got into print as I know of, but I know what happened because I was there and done seen it. It was my old friend Bill that I've mentioned before in the columns of this here cow paper. Hadn't seen Bill for a spell, having been down in the lower country, but I was like Betsy from Pike in the old song. I was full of that strong alkali, so I drug it for the high country again, where there was good water and lots of work in the summertime. I got into the little town where we used to hold out, and says hello to the bartender, and sort of relaxes as folks says these times, and takes to waiting for Bill between drinks. I'm in a friendly frame of mind when I see Bill coming. He's riding a raw bronc that he can just about turn with a hackamore. I don't rush out to meet him like some politician, this not being good manners in them parts. He knows where I'll be if I'm in town, so he looks for a place to tie. Arter gone out and let him tie onto my saddle horn, but I was in a state of mind where a feller overlooks any trifling matters. Bill can't tie to no porch posts, for the bronc might set back and bust him, and there's a few old buggy and wagon teams tied to the only 2 hitching racks in town, and if the bronc tears down the rack, it's going to bust up things bad. Bill don't think to go and turn him in the corral back of the livery stable, but he gets one of his big ideas. Next to the saloon is the pool room with a cigar stand, and out on the board porch is a cigar statue of an Injun. In one hand he's holding out a bunch of cigars, and the other a tomahawk all raised like he was going to knock you in the head. I sort of figured he was supposed to be just daring any feller to try and swipe his terbacker. This Injun chief is stood up on a high pedestal that has rollers under it like one of them fancy bedsteads. I see right off that Bill has got a couple of drinks someplace before he lit in town, for he has that look he always had when he didn't care a cuss for nothing. He looks the layout over, and then he checks the bronc, and gets down, and gets his hoss as close as he can to the cigar engine, and ties his rope right around the middle. Then he comes up to where I am, and we cuss each other out right friendly, go inside, take a few, and find out what we've been doing for the last year and then some. We're just to the point where Bill tells me about how a married woman that I admired a heap is now divorced and living happy ever after, when the citizen that runs the cigar place busts into the bar room and starts to throw sand on his back about that hoss being tied to that cigar stature. Being in a peaceful humor, me and Bill starts out to move the hoss. But this here peevish little cuss gets in front of us, and to make a showin' he rushes over and sort of points his finger on the bronc. Well, the hoss jumps back and jerks the rope, and that Injun chief on the rolling pedestal goes right toward him. The bronc don't know whether the Injun aims to feed him terbacker or brain him with the tomahawk, and he ain't waiting to see. There's been some talk about who led Geronimo out of Mexico, but there was no doubt about who led this Injun out from there. It was Bill's hoss. He sure went from there a running and a kicking. The cigar stature following about 3 feet behind when it ain't swinging in circles. The pedestal busted loose first, and then the arms, legs, and tomahawk, and the wooden feathers and the trabacker sorter scattered out, and the bronc fogged it down the street with just the main chunk of dragon. A public-spirited buckboard team broke loose and joined, and an old lady did a sprint that I ain't seen beat yet. Some chickens was prospecting around out in the road, but they all go out from there leaving a few feathers that settled down with the dust. The hoss goes round a corner, and the chunky's dragon catches on the post of the rickety old barbed wire fence, busting the post and turning the hoss for a grunt knocker. Bill and me is follering, and not running very straight, but pretty fast, considering the load we was carrying. We gets to the hoss before he gets up and gathers enough wind to run again, but we just gets the rope when he blows his stopper again and drags and wallers me and Bill all around, him being in the state of mind where he can't tell us from the cigar stature. The citizens begin to show their heads here and there, and finally comes the town marshal, him being the last to arrive at the trouble, as is customary. Bill had to pay for that engine, and we always figured the price was pretty steep. But then, we wasn't art collectors, and I bet Bill is the first and only actual cowpuncher that ever bought a stature. That was the only engine upraising me and Bill was ever mixed up with. But it goes to show the terrible treachery of the engine character. A engine chief won't do to tie to. This is Bill Meets a Funeral. Now, speaking of funerals, it makes me think of one that me and Bill met up with. It's like this. Me and Bill have took time off to go to town and is just washed and shaved when the old man says to us that we needn't saddle up, for he's just catched up his buckboard team that's been running out quite a spell, and he figures it'll be a good idea for me and Bill to hitch them up to an old spring wagon and work them to town and back so that they be sorter smoothed out for his buckboard work. We agrees, and then the old man says for us to tie in a whole passel of dry hides that's been hanging round the place and leave them at the hide house when we get to town. The old man sure don't overlook nothing, I says to Bill. He sure does, says Bill, or you wouldn't have worked for him as much as you have. I could have told Bill a few things, but it ain't no use, so I just helps him get the hides piled into the back of the old spring wagon and tied on for keeps. Everybody on the place thinks of something he wants from town, seeing we're going with a wagon, and the cook comes out with 2 pair of shoes and a gunny sack, which he wants half sold. We gets hitched, and the team ain't so good. Bill is driving. The nigh horse tries to start, but the off horse starts a necking party by rearing up and putting his hate over the nigh hoss. But I strings him out by throwing the sack of shoes and hitting him alongside the hate, and he leaves from there right now. I figured the shoes could go to town some other time. Nothing much happened till we got to town where we sees a saloon that says, First Chance, on the sign, and we stops and has a couple to sorter rile us up, and then starts on to get rid of them hides and put the team in a livery stable. The town had a Opry House and a bank, and generally speaking, was a town. We just got to the main corner when around come a funeral. That was 2 hosses to the hearse, and they'd sorter bushes of feathers stuck on their bridles, and the 2 fellers on the seat had on plug hats and white gloves and frock coats. The hearse team takes 1 look at our load of hides and sets right up on the britching. Our team hadn't never seen men dressed like them and setting up so high, and they whirled round and hightailed it before we could do a thing. They busted loose from the spring wagon, which upshot and throwed me and Bill out onto the hard walk in front of the bank, and then they got onto the paved walk across the street where they had about as much luck as a couple of billy goats on a dance floor, and they slipped down and got all tangled up. The hearse hosses is looking into the winder of a store across the street, but the funeral's still right side up, and some men is hanging on to the team. A cow waddy and a mule skinner is setting on our team holding them down. A feller that knows me says, Shorty, what are you setting in front of the bank for? Because they's money in it, says Bill. I feel like I was knocked loose from most all everything I ever had. I wasn't used to being slung on the pavement, and then a passel of dry hides in a spring wagon rolled over onto me. Bill is on his feet and cussing, and I'm just going to arise, when I looks up and there stands the purtiest little lady with big blue eyes, and I'd have thought she was an angel if I hadn't seen her step up on the curb. They's a milliner store across the street, and I figures this is the milliner lady sure enough. You bet I leans right back again against that load of hides and takes to grunting like a bloated steer. "Is there anything I can do for you?" says this lovely little lady. I pretends to have trouble speaking, and I says, "Lady," I says, "I'm sort of shook inward-like, and if there was a quiet place where I could sit for a spill, I reckon I'd be all right." "Come right over to the store," she says, and she helps me up and puts her arm around me and leads me over to the store. I looks back at Bill, and when I catched his eye, I see jealousy and anger there plumb apparent. That don't bother me none, and I lays down on a lounge in the back of the store and leaves Bill to fix the wreck while the milliner lady gives me a fancy bottle to smell of which she says is salts. I thanks her for the bottle and smells of the salts but don't take none. But then the milliner lady is another story, so I reckon I better stop with just me and Bill and the funeral. This is Bill Doctors the Chimleys. There was a dance at the little town hall, and I was invited by the committee. Me and Bill didn't go together because I was some ways from there and didn't know whether I could go or not, and Bill, being sore, didn't wait for me and went with two fellers that had just come into the country. I got there when the dance was in full swing, and I see there was a sort of hostile feeling of some kind. And didn't take me long to figure out that it was Bill and them other two Rannies that was at the bottom of it. They was sure lit up and was a-making a lot of wisecracks and doing a lot of unnecessary jigging on the corners and swinging gals by the waist that had always been swung just by the hands. They wanted me to have a drink, so I went out and took one or two just to be peaceful and friendly-like. But it got to me where I could get the idea of the way them other three boys was feeling. 'Twern't no use to try and jine up with them, for they had too much head start on me. But after that it was sort of funny to watch. They was three men on the committee, and they was three waddies making the ruckus, so I figured, all things being free and equal, it was a good idea to give everybody concerned their haid and let 'em buck. But them three hay shakers that was giving the ball had another idea, and the next thing I see was the old village marshal a-showing his badge to the boys and inviting 'em to vamoose. The other two Rannies was for starting something, but Bill, he augured 'em out of it, and they all went out peaceful. Then the wife of one of them committee fellers says she's glad they went, and that the folks there is ranching in the valley don't want ignorant cowhands a-coming in and messing up their social doings, and she wishes them as hadn't already went would go away now. That sorter got under my hide, for I seen right now how most of them hayshakers felt about us cow folks. I went outside, and I heard one old feller say that his brother had sent him a sack of walnuts all the way from Missouri, and he took a couple of his friends over to his wagon and give 'em each a pocketful. Then they go to another wagon and fishes out a jug and all drinked and says to each other that the committee is sure enough three smart fellers and plumb gentlemen. They didn't see me at all, and I was glad they didn't, for it give me a chance to hit up their jug. After a couple of drinks and a few minutes of thought, I catched a right pert idea. I got my hoss where I could grab him right quick, and then went over to the back of the boarding house and got a big slop bucket off in the back porch. I dumped out what slop was in it, knocked the ice out of it, and poured it plumb full of them walnuts. There was a lamp burning at the bottom of the town hall stairs, which I blowed out right now. The door was open, and they was a-doing the over-the-waves waltz. I gets close to the top of the stairs, and then I slings that bucket of walnuts all over the top steps and the top landing, and wave the old slop bucket by the bale and lets her go in amongst 'em for good measure, and I yells like a wild man, and then I runs out and rides hell for leather toward the feed lot where Bill is feeding beef about 5 miles from there. When I gets to his shack, I don't find nobody. I'm plumb anxious about Bill and them other two Rannies. Also, I feel a little bit lonesome in case the committee or some of the town marshal's friends might come a-visiting out there. Of course, there ain't nothing they can prove, but there might be a heap of things they can do if there happens to be several of them. I see them two strange rannies has throwed their beds in the shack, so I crawls into Bill's hot roll, and I'm waked up some time later when them three boys rides up. The next day we fills up the feed racks good and plenty and have just knocked off work early when the boss drives up in his buckboard. I ain't said nothing about the night before to the boys, and they ain't said nothing to me, for each figures that the other fellows let go awful easy. The boss, he goes into the house, and pretty soon we all eases in to get the powders, whatever there are going to be. We all lights the smoke, and then he says, "Boys," he says, "they was sorter a ruckus down to town last night. I ain't blaming nobody nor taking sides. Bill and these here Texas boys done right by leaving the dance peaceful when they was asked to, although they hadn't ought to raise so much sand while they was there. But they never done right when they took the ladders from the alfalfa stacks and clumb up on the houses of all them committee fellers and the town marshal and plugged them chimneys full of gunny sacks and hoss blankets and such. Them men and their family come home along toward morning and tried to light a fire. They never knowed what was wrong, and they tore the stove pipes down and everything, and they had to put the women and kids to bed while they clung on top of the house and uncorked their chimneys. One man froze his foot, another man his ear, and Zeb Thompson cut his hand all to the dickens on the stovepipe. The other boys looked sad-like, but I can't help from busting out laughing right now. The boss lets me have my laugh, and then he says to me, "Look a yar, Shorty, you ain't got no call to laugh none. You went and took that sack of walnuts out from Lige Bascom's wagon and poured 'em into the boarding house slop bucket and slung 'em all over the top steps and the landing of the town hall. And when you slung the bucket into the crowd, you like to broke my sister-in-law's leg. The crowd all run out to get you, and they tromped on them walnuts and fell and slipped all over theirselves, and quite a passel of 'em fell down the stairs. The town marshal hit his tailbone on the steps and is just about paralyzed. Him and his woman had to stay at a neighbor's on account of his chimney was plugged. There was no warm place to doctor him." The boss fills his pipe again and says, "Now, I figure to send you young sprouts to build a ground tank at the place over between the hogbacks, and I'm sending them two old fellers out to feed the beef and watch the line camp. If these here Texas boys want to do tanking work, I reckon they might join in." That plan took us all as being agreeable, and the boss went out to go home. Bill looks out at the winder. "Look," he says, "the boss has took violent with a spell." He starts out, but one of them big long Texans grabs him. "Never mind," says Tex. "He ain't used to laughing so hard. He's sort of doubled up like. It was right good of him to keep us all in these parts after the ruckus. Howsomever, I was a-watching that sister-in-law his'n, and I reckon he wouldn't have felt so kind toward us if Shorty hadn't hit her in the leg with that there boarding house slop bucket." The next story is entitled, "City Folks Go Bear Hunting." Bill and me was sent to the upper ranch in the hills to pack in some salt for the cattle up on that fork of the creek. They'd hauled the salt as far as old man Harbin's place by wagon, but from there on we had to pack it in. When we gets to Harbin's place, it looked like Barnum and Bailey's circus is there, for they was four tents and a whole passel of towerists with fishing poles that had little spools and cranks on 'em, and old Harbin has give it out that he is a guide. And the next day them folks is going to pay him to show 'em where to catch all the trout they can carry, and also for the privilege of camping on his land. The boss keeps a packing outfit cached at Harbin's place, and furnishes the salt for Harbin's cattle and his too, for which Harbin stakes us to pack animals to get up onto the range. We overhauled the outfit, and them towerists was all around us a-looking and asking questions. I slips out and gets to a place where there's some soft ground below the corral, and I goes to work and fixes a few tracks that looks like sure enough bear tracks. I has to laugh, for I ain't done like that since us kids used to set in the dust and fix tracks and brands, and ask them old fellers if we had made 'em right. Well, Pretty soon I takes them Jaspers and shows them bear tracks, and right now they wakes up and we finds that they have enough Winchesters and shotguns and six-shooters to lick the Arkansas Cavalry and the Missouri Militia. Bill says that all town folks goes armed if they get where they ain't no sidewalks. They invites us over to supper, and we says we'll be there. Bill tells his ID to me, and it ain't bad at all. We goes and fills our pockets with corn before we goes over to their camp. And when we leaves, it's plumb dark. So we scatters that corn around just outside the firelight. Then we goes and gets some more corn and lays a thin trail of it from the gate of the old man's hog pen up to where we can scatter the other corn. I'd gone to sleep when Bill wakes me, and it's right late. We takes a couple more handfuls of corn and goes to the pen where them three hogs is. Bill keeps a clucking to them, and we throws them a sprinkle of corn at the gate of the pen and lets them out. They starts right off following that feed, and a rootin' and a snuffin' and a growlin' and a gruntin', and they sounded like all the bears in them parts was there with their relations. Bill says, "Shorty, we better get behind a rock pile that was handy," and wasn't long before I knowed Bill was right. We waited for a spell, and the hogs was a-follerin' that feed trail right along. And then it sure sounded like the Battle of Bull Run, for all the shootin' irons in that camp was going off, and I heard old man Harbin's winder glass bust somewhere in the house, and a hog a-squealin' over at the Towerist camp, and some big slugs of lead come close enough to so me and Bill heard him too. Old man Harbin comes out with a lantern, and everybody was a-hollerin' to each other. They found one dead hog, and the other had vamoosed from their plumb pronto. They builds up the fire, and seeing we had no way for to scald the hog right then, we skun him and dressed him and hung him up. The Towerists thought it was a lot of fun, but me and Bill seen the way that old man Harbin's eyes looked and the way his whiskers sort of worked whenever he looked at us. We figured we better get that salt packed in and get away from there before them Towerists did. We don't have time to go through another complete chapter of Shorty's Yarns, Western Stories and Poems of Bruce Kiscadden, but I'd like to read for you a section of a book that we encountered before, but that I was never able to share with you. I'm going to read a brief selection from Powell's book, The Exploration of the Colorado River, and this section is Powell enters the Grand Canyon August 13 and 14, 1869. August 13. We're now ready to start on our way down the great unknown. Our boats, tied to a common stake, are chafing each other as they are tossed by the fretful river. They ride high and buoyant, for their loads are lighter than we would desire. We have but a month's rations remaining. The flour has been re-sifted through the mosquito net sieve. The spoiled bacon has been dried and the worst of it boiled. The few pounds of dried apples have been spread in the sun and re-shrunken to their normal bulk. The sugar is all melted and gone on its way down the river, but we have a large sack of coffee. The lightening of the boats has this advantage. They will ride the waves better, and we shall have but little to carry when we make a portage. We have 3/4 of a mile in the depths of the earth, and the great river shrinks into insignificance as it dashes its angry waves against the walls and cliffs that rise to the world above. They are but puny ripples, and we but pygmies, running up and down the sands or lost among the boulders. We have an unknown distance yet to run, an unknown river yet to explore. What falls there are, we know not. What rocks beset the channel, we know not. What walls rise over the river, we know not. Ah, well, we may conjecture many things. The men talk as cheerfully as ever. Jests are bandied about freely this morning, but to me the cheer is somber and the jests are ghastly. With some eagerness and some anxiety and some misgiving, we enter the canyon below and are carried along by the swift water through the walls which rise from its very edge. They have the same structure as we noticed yesterday, tiers of irregular shelves below and above these, steep slopes to the foot of marble cliffs. We run 6 miles in a little more than half an hour and emerge into a more open portion of the canyon, where high hills and ledges of rock intervene between the river and the distant walls. Just at the head of this open place, the river runs across a dike, that is, a fissure in the rocks, open to depths below, and it has been filled with eruptive matter. And this, on cooling, was harder than the rocks through which the crevice was made, and when these were washed away, the harder volcanic matter remained as a wall, and the river has cut a gateway through it several hundred feet high and as many wide. As it crosses the wall, there is a fall below, and a bad rapid filled with boulders of trap, so we stop to make a portage. Then we go, gliding by hills and ledges, with distant walls in view, sweeping past sharp angles of rock, stopping at a few points to examine rapids, which we find can be run, until we make another 5 miles when we land for dinner. Then we let down the lines over a long raid and start again. Once more the walls close in, and we find ourselves in a narrow gorge, the water again filling the channel and very swift. With great care and constant watchfulness, we proceed, making about 4 miles this afternoon, and camp in a cave. August 14. At daybreak, we walk down the bank of the river on a little sandy beach to take a view of a new feature in the canyon. Heretofore, hard rocks had given us bad river, soft rocks, smooth water, and a series of rocks harder than any we have experienced sets in. The river enters the granite. We can see but a little way into the gorge, but it looks threatening. After breakfast, we enter on the waves. At the very introduction, it inspires awe. The canyon is narrower than we have ever before seen it, the water swifter. There are but few broken rocks in the channel, and the walls are set on either side with pinnacles and crags, and sharp angular buttresses bristling with wind and wave-polished spires extend far out into the river. Ledges of rocks jut into the stream, their tops sometimes just below the surface, sometimes rising few or many feet above. And island ledges and island pinnacles and island towers break the swift course of the stream into chutes and eddies and whirlpools. We soon reach a place where a creek comes in from the left, and just below the channel is choked with boulders, which have washed down this lateral canyon and formed a dam, over which there is a fall of 30 or 40 feet. But on the boulders we can get a foothold, and we make a portage. 3 more such dams are found. Over one we make a portage. At the other two we find chutes through which we can run. As we proceed, the granite rises higher until nearly 1,000 feet of the lower part of the walls are composed of this rock. About 11 o'clock we hear a great roar ahead and approach it cautiously. The ground grows louder and louder as we run, and at last we find ourselves along a long broken fall, with ledges and pinnacles of rock obstructing the river. There is descent of perhaps 75 or 80 feet in 1/3 of a mile, and the rushing waters break into great waves on the rocks and lash themselves into a mad white foam. We can land just above, but there is no foothold on either side by which we can make a portage. It's nearly 1,000 feet to the top of the granite, so it will be impossible to carry our boats around, though we can climb to the summit up a side gulch, and passing along 1 or 2 miles, can descend to the river. This we find on examination, but such a portage would be impracticable for us, and we must run the rapid or abandon the river. There is no hesitation. We step into our boats, push off, and away we go, first on smooth but swift water, then we strike a glassy wave, and ride to its top, down again into the trough, up again on a higher wave, and down and up on waves higher and still higher, until we strike one just as it curls back, and a breaker rolls over our little boat. Still on we speed, shooting past projecting rocks, till the little boat is caught in a whirlpool and spun around several times. At last we pull out again into the stream, and now the other boats have passed us. The open compartment of the Emma Dean is filled with water, and every breaker rolls over us. Hurled back from a rock, now on this side, now on that, we are carried into an eddy, in which we struggle for a few minutes, and are then out again, the breakers still rolling over us. Our boat is unmanageable, but she cannot sink, and we drift down another 100 yards through breakers.
How, we scarcely know. We find the other boats have turned into an eddy at the foot of the fall and are waiting to catch us as we come, for the men have seen that our boat is swamped. They push out as we come near and push us against the wall. We bail our boat, and on we go again. The walls now are more than a mile in height, a vertical distance difficult to appreciate. Stand on the south steps of the Treasury Building in Washington, and look down Pennsylvania Avenue to the Capitol Park, and measure this distance overhead, and imagine cliffs to extend to that altitude, and you will understand what I mean. Or stand at Canal Street in New York, and look up Broadway to Grace Church, and you have the distance. Or stand at Lake Street Bridge in Chicago, and look down to the Central Depot, and you have it again. 1,000 feet of this up and through granite crags, then steep slopes, and perpendicular cliffs arise, one above another, to the summit. And that was Powell Enters the Grand Canyon, August 13 and 14, 1869, an excerpt from his book, The Exploration of the Colorado River.
Thank you for joining us for Western Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. In addition, you can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.